The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Well, this is a bonus episode since there are 5 weeks in July, and this episode will have even more opportunity to get into the stories that I often have to trim out for Our State Magazine. So the theme for this month continues to be all about summer fun. The first story here is called A Waterman's Wisdom. At his seafood market in Jacksonville, a seasoned fisherman shows his customers that when it comes to our coast and the rich bounty it provides, the world is their oyster. Southern Breeze Seafood has the clean, cold smell of an iceberg. Every day the shop makes tons of the stuff, mounting cubes and chips into banks and bergs upon which the freshest of fresh catch sits to tempt customers. Heaps of shrimp, their eyes black and oil bright. Flounder in an orderly file, rows of tuna steaks glowing with garnet light, a vermilion snapper, a school of spot, a rocky reef of oysters. On the walls hang generations-old buoys and markers for crab pots, nets, and lines, their owners' initials etched deep into the foam, and cork bobbers. Baskets and shelves hold seasonings and seafood breaders, lemons and limes, corn and potatoes, everything you need for a seafood feast. What Southern Breeze Seafood doesn't have is the odor of fish, or cleaner, or anything else other than fresh. A seafood market shouldn't smell, said Captain John Mallett, a Sneed's Ferry native, commercial and charter fishing captain, and co-owner of Southern Breeze Seafood. When the seafood's fresh, it smells like nothing. He pauses, thinks a moment. Maybe it's kind of like an ocean breeze, a little salty, but totally clean. If anyone knows about the salt-laced ocean breeze, about seafood, and about the waters of North Carolina and the creatures that call them home, it's John Mallett. Captain John is the epitome of southeastern North Carolina fishermen, says Keith Rhodes, whose Wilmington restaurant Catch has been showcasing the chef's own passion for North Carolina seafood since 2006. He grew up in the industry and the lifestyle of a fisherman. I always saw him by the water, either on the docks or on the boats. He's a real lifer in seafood. A shrimp boat travels the New River, masts spread wide like pelican wings, heading out to the ocean. A pair of trawlers stand tied to the dock, acres of red and green netting draping to their decks. Mallett watches from his booth at Riverview Cafe, surveying the waters where he learned the art of fishing, pointing out the old-timers and anglers his age. He jokes that he's been at this so long he's seen as an old-timer, too. He was raised on decks and docks, in fish houses and seafood markets, never far from the water, a fishing rod, the tiller of a boat. I was a dock rat, he says. Starting when I was 7, Mrs. Betty Warren would babysit me, and I spent many days at the feet of the women picking crabs and shucking oysters. Her husband, Preston, he'd take me out in his boat to shrimp. I fell in love with all of this early. In those days, there were more than a few shrimping and commercial fishing boats on the waters around Sneed's Ferry. There were more seafood houses as well. Mallett learned to shuck and clean by watching those women and other locals. He eventually graduated from running errands suitable for a 7-year-old boy to heading shrimp and filleting flounder himself. That is when he wasn't cutting a mess of shrimp on Preston's boat, separating other sea life accidentally caught alongside the shrimp and tossing it overboard. He was an apt pupil, soaking up stories and lore from the elder fishermen in the way that only young ears and a growing mind can. These men and their tales of the sea and storm and days on the water filled his imagination, charting a path for the rest of his life. Mallett fished. He shrimped. He dug for clams and harvested oysters. With Preston, with other Sneed's Ferry fishermen on the pier at Topsail Island's Ocean City Beach, where at one time was the only place in North Carolina where black people could buy seaside property. It was on the Ocean City Pier where Mallett learned an important lesson. For a while, chefs and foodies were talking about trash fish, he said skeptically. But there's no such thing as trash fish. There's fish you know and fish you don't know. That's it. When I was young, I'd watch these old-timers on the pier pull up puffer fish and show them on the boards to die, said they were no good. He rolls his eyes. I'd gather them up and take them home. Man, they didn't know what they were missing. The puffer fish in North Carolina aren't the toxic fugu from Japan, which are dangerous and even deadly if prepared by the untrained. Millette says that our puffers are the true chicken of the sea, easier to clean, easier to eat. Today, chefs have wised up to unfamiliar seafood, and the term trash fish has been replaced with bycatch, indicating that the species in question was an unintended catch. Millette would like to see that term evolve, but more importantly, he wants to see people's seafood eating habits change. My job is to educate people, to show them there's more to eat than the 6 or 8 species of fish they know, he says. I want to take those fish eaters and convert them into seafood lovers. I want folks to look at me like a butcher for seafood. Millette has been on course for the life of a fisherman since boyhood, and by the time he was in 10th grade, he was earning real money, by his account, some $80,000 a year. His father died before Millette could form memories of the man, so the money he earned helped the household immensely, which led his mother to make a startling suggestion. She knew I loved fishing and being on the water. She knew school didn't interest me much, Millette says, so she encouraged me to drop out, fish full-time, and get my GED as soon as I could. It was a bold move. He left school, spent days and nights on the water, and soon after his class graduated, he earned his diploma. 6 months later, I was in Australia, a hired deckhand on charter fishing trips on the Great Barrier Reef. Australia, Costa Rica, Panama, the Caribbean, Hawaii. But Sneed's Ferry always called him home. There he fished, he dreamed, he saw Sneed's Ferry the way it had been, waters full of fishing boats, docks busy with watermen, seafood houses awash in fresh catch. He and partner Randy Millis opened Southern Breeze Seafood, selling to the public. A raft of lauded chefs, including James Beard nominees and winners like Chef Rhodes and Chef Ricky Moore, and restaurants from Charlotte to Raleigh to Charleston, South Carolina. Millette and Millis launched a line of seafood breaders in partnership with Oriental-based Tidewater Grain Company, a gluten-free, non-GMO product that Millette uses on his own food truck. Yet even as Millette worked to promote and celebrate seafood from the waters he knew best, he saw a gulf growing between customers and the local fishing industry. He wanted people to understand the difference between local, domestic, and imported seafood and to grasp the positive economic impact that customers have when they buy from local fishmongers instead of big box grocers. He wanted to raise awareness about how often seafood sold in the United States is mislabeled. He wanted to help his customers understand how to buy seafood and what questions to ask when they do. So he embarked on a mission to educate the public. He was invited to speak on the Got to Be in Sea stage at the State Fair. He's done the same at other events, including the Sneed's Ferry Shrimp Festival, where he sits on the board. He's also on the board of NC Catch, a seafood advocacy group. John has a real vision for North Carolina seafood, Rhodes says. His is an important voice in North Carolina catch because he's young, visionary, and so knowledgeable when it comes to fishing methods, species, regulations, and real solutions. I think of him as the meeting point of North Carolina's fishing past and its future. At Southern Breeze, Millette lives up to Rhodes' ideal. From behind the case of fish, he greets customers by name, conversing as he portions out a pound and scoops a little extra ice into a bag. He guides them to the freshest tuna that North Carolina waters can offer. He talks about spot that were swimming yesterday and about local fish fries, about the way things used to be. Even though Millette says he's more comfortable in the water than behind the counter, he shines as he converts fish eaters to seafood lovers, a champion for a true taste of our state. Southern Breeze Seafood is on Richlands Highway, Jacksonville, North Carolina, and you can find out more about them at southernbreezeseafood.com. And here's some advice from Captain John. The butcher of seafood has advice for buying the best catch that you can find. Number one, develop a relationship with your local fishmonger and learn to trust them. They know what's fresh and in season, and they know how to cook it. Number two, don't be afraid to ask questions. Where was this caught? When was it caught? When did you get it? These are all good questions because they show the fishmonger that you're serious and interested. Number three, Learn, explore, and try. Take a chance on a species you're unfamiliar with. Try a new way to cook. Grab a whole fish if you never have. We seafood lovers, we love it when you're curious. Number 4, look for the seal. BAP, Best Aquaculture Practices, and MSC, Marine Stewardship Council, certifications on imported seafood indicate that the supplier used the best industry standards to farm-raise their seafood or responsibly and sustainably catch what's on offer. Number 5, if you have a question, ask for packaging. Any true and honest fishmonger wants you to be knowledgeable about seafood, so when you wonder if that salmon really was wild-caught in Norway, ask to see the packaging or a label showing its origin. And lastly, don't be afraid of frozen seafood. Unless you're catching it yourself, odds are your seafood was frozen. Flash freezers hit temperatures of 20 degrees below freezing, negative 20 degrees Fahrenheit, freezing the catch solid quickly and keeping it at just caught fresh for up to a year. When seafood like this is thawed properly, it's an outstanding product. Next, we're going to move to the NC icons. I don't often get to read this little article, so this will be nice. Halifax resolves. In 1776, on a small hillside just beyond the Roanoke River in Halifax County, North Carolina, made the loudest declaration yet heard in the history of the 13 colonies. There, the state's fourth provincial congress, made up of colonial heavy hitters with last names like Harnett, Ash, Caswell, Person, and Haywood, met in the 18th century metropolis of Halifax on April 12th. While Halifax is small by today's standards, it was at that time one of the colony's larger destinations. In the 1770s, the town was home to 900 residents, several taverns, and the last major port inland. The congressmen likely gathered in the town's first courthouse, a T-shaped structure next to a jail that held British prisoners of war captured during the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge earlier that year. The North Carolinians put quill to scroll and resolved to recommend that the 13 colonies seek independence from the usurpations and violences attempted and committed by the King and Parliament of Britain against America, close quote. 3 months later, in July, three North Carolina delegates, William Hooper, Joseph Hewis, and John Penn, signed the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia. The moment marked North Carolina's transformation into a free state. Nearly 250 years later, archaeologists gathered on that same hillside to learn more about this place and time that defined our state and country. They carefully shoveled and sifted through dirt, looking for clues of the past. Bent screws, broken glass, shards of cracked dishes. Archaeologists have been studying this area since the 1960s, but they didn't know the exact location of the courthouse until 2022, when ground-penetrating radar found lines of packed soil in the shape of a capital T. The spot matched the building's location on old maps, commissioned by Governor William Tryon. Today, small piles of broken artifacts sit on an observation table near the excavation site. Bits of blue and green pottery, the foot of a piece of stemware, a thick piece of olive green glass identified as the bottom of a wine bottle. Put these pieces together and an image of a celebration begins to form, an image of a young North Carolina government toasting to a promising future. And there's a couple little extra little articles here, small ones. A noble namesake. Children ride ornate horses on a carousel that's been the centerpiece of John Chavis Memorial Park since it opened in Raleigh in 1937. Born in Granville County in 1763, Chavis came to Halifax as an indentured servant. As a free man, he joined the Revolution, fighting for American independence. After the war, he became the first black man in the country to receive a college education. In the early 1800s, he moved to Raleigh and opened a school where he taught white students during the day and black students at night. Chavis was forced to close his school in the early 1830s after the General Assembly made public teaching and preaching illegal for people of color, a law he fought against until he died in 1838. Almost a century later, the park was dedicated to Chavis, honoring his legacy of education and equality for all. The John Chavis Memorial Park is located on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Raleigh, and you can go to RaleighNC.gov and do a search for John Chavis Memorial Park for more information. The historical marker at John Chavis Memorial Park, installed in 1938, was the first in the state to recognize African American history. Let freedom ring. On July 4th, a crowd in Halifax will watch reenactors fire muskets and hear an interactive reading of the Declaration of Independence. Nearly 250 years ago, on August 1st, 1776, American founding father and Wilmington politician Cornelius Harnett stood before a similar crowd gathered on King Street in Halifax to hear the first reading of the Declaration of Independence in North Carolina. As Harnett concluded the reading, cannons were fired, and the crowd of free Americans cheered. Though things have changed since those days, fireworks have replaced cannons, and the musket fires blanks, we'll never stop celebrating. And there's a little picture over here. It's like a mural in Halifax. It commemorates the Halifax Resolves. It's got the North Carolina flag on the right and the American flag with the 13 colonies represented with the stars in the center, along with a couple of different landmarks in Halifax. Copies of the Halifax Resolves, the focus of a miracle on King Street in downtown Halifax, were sent to North Carolina's three delegates in Philadelphia. And again, those were William Hooper, Joseph Hewis, and John Penn. Turning to the food and feasts section of the magazine, this article is entitled Lunch on the Line. It's about a location in Lexington, North Carolina. And the caption here, the photo is of a plate of fried chicken, macaroni and cheese, and what looks like collard greens, along with some other dishes that are a little bit blurry, intentionally, I'm sure, from the photographer. It says, when diners walk into Southern Lunch, they're greeted by a 1950s scene featuring the restaurant and its namesake, the Southern Railway, and by the scent of fried chicken, mac and cheese, and collard greens. Lunch on the Line is the name of the article. Nearly a century ago, a young man opened a restaurant to feed passengers leaving the old depot in Lexington. Though Southern Railway is no more, people still travel to the family-owned lunch spot for a plate full of comfort food. From the front door of Lexington's Southern Lunch, owner Herb Lohr can still see what inspired his grandfather to open the restaurant nearly a century ago, the railroad tracks. Back in the day, there was a passenger depot for the Southern Railway, practically right across the street from the restaurant's current location. Where most people just saw railroad tracks and a depot, 25-year-old Herbert Lohr, Herb's grandfather and namesake, saw an opportunity. With so many passengers coming through the station and with several furniture factories operating within walking distance of the depot, the young entrepreneur recognized that all those people needed a place to eat. In 1925, he opened the small short order grill and called it Southern Lunch, a nod to the burgeoning Southern Railway. The counter-only diner was open 7 days a week from 5:30 a.m. to midnight. At first, it was just hamburgers and hot dogs and probably chips, Herb says, but then he started adding to it. Today, Southern Lunch sits across the street from its original building and has grown into a family restaurant that specializes in seafood and country cooking. So country, in fact, that you might think that its name refers to the food or the hospitality rather than the railroad company. You can still order the original Depression-era bread burger, a hamburger patty plumped with bread and other ingredients to stretch the beef, but most diners opt for the more popular comfort foods on the menu, country-style steak, chicken dumplings, stew beef, and chicken pie. They're all served with piles of vegetables and often a very sweet tea. Ironically, in this city that's known for its barbecue, that's one thing that you won't find on the menu. This may be a barbecue town, but we've been here a lot longer than any barbecue restaurant, said Herb's cousin, Philip Lohr, who worked at Southern Lunch as a teenager and still often eats there. Like Philip, Herb grew up working in the family business, beginning at age 12. His father, Fred, took over the restaurant in 1958, and Herb became the third-generation owner in 1981 at age 21. Now at 65, he's old enough to have seen multiple generations become regulars. Some customers even make weekly trips from out of town. Barry and Lorna Mettinger of Salisbury, some 20 miles away, eat at Southern Lunch 3 or 4 nights a week. "I've been eating here since 1972 when I worked for the railroad," Barry says. "That's more than 50 years of Southern Lunch loyalty, a testimony that would make the elder Herbert smile. Nearly a century after he began his small restaurant by the railroad, it's still on the right track. Southern Lunch is located on South Railroad Street in Lexington, and there's a Facebook page for them, facebook.com/Southern Lunch Lexington. Another quick article from the Food and Feast sections. This is a farm tour from Lucama, entitled, the article's entitled Magic Beans. A multi-generational family farm in eastern North Carolina supplies visitors with bushels of butter beans. Plump and velvety, these light green legumes have been so embraced in the South that folks here have their own name for them, butter beans. Natives of the North or Midwest might ask for baby limas, which is how the family behind Sullivan Farms in Lucama knows their newcomers. Katie Sullivan had a bit to learn herself when she married into this fifth-generation family farm that straddles Johnston and Wilson counties. Unlike her husband, Scott, she didn't grow up digging potatoes and pulling a wagon loaded with sweet corn. "We were dating, and somehow he talked me into it. Let's grow butter beans," she says. Some 20 years later, they have 3 daughters and about 30 acres of this finicky, short-season crop. From July to mid-August, customers travel 4 miles off Interstate 95 and drive up the path past the old tobacco barns to buy fresh butter beans by the bushel. On occasion, folks might request beans still in the shells so their grandchildren have the chance to shell them. But there's no such thing as pick your own beans. Picking strawberries, that's a fun thing, Katie says, laughing. No one's ever asked to pick butter beans. Scott Sullivan grew up on his great-grandfather's land, where he and his wife Katie and their daughters Anna Claire, Lisa, and Molly now tend to butter bean crops in the summer. And there's a picture here of a big bowl of butter beans, well-cooked and seasoned butter beans, I'm sure. For more information on Sullivan Farms, they're on St. Mary's Church Road in Lucama, and they have a Facebook page, facebook.com/SullivanFarmsNC. Flipping over to the roads and routes, we have a quirky detour, a first-rate skipper. This is out of Morehead City. A beloved sailor spent his life on the waters around Carteret County. Today, a bronze bust pays tribute to his friendly nature and passion for the sea. This is right where the late Jimmy Woo Woo Parker would have wanted to be. If Harker, a veteran boat captain and commercial fisherman, couldn't be on the water, he would have cherished this spot overlooking Bogue Sound, where he could not only see the water, but also smell it, taste the salt in the air, and even feel its soft spray on his face from time to time. And so it is that in Harker's native Morehead City, where Evans and South 6th Streets converge at the waterfront, a memorial to the beloved sea captain beckons to passers-by, encouraging them to stop and appreciate, if only for a moment, those who dedicate their lives to working on the water. The memorial features a bronze bust of Harker perched atop a marble pedestal. A plaque explains that the statue is placed there both in memory of Harker and to collectively honor everyone who works where the sea meets the sky, as Harker did for decades. Woo Woo was an expert mariner and an expert fisherman, says longtime friend Terrell Gould, who now owns and operates the Carolina Prince's Headboat, a vessel that takes more than 6 passengers out to sea to fish. The boat was once skippered by Harker. He grew up on the water, and he loved it. That's what he did all his life. Raised at Shell Point on Harker's Island, James Benjamin Woo Woo Parker IV began taking fishing parties out to sea as a boy. He had to stand on an old Pepsi Cola crate just to see over the steering wheel, but he knew the water as well as any veteran sea captain. It was also in his youth that Harker earned the nickname Woo Woo, a nod to how much he enjoyed wooing women. After high school, Harker worked for a time on a research vessel, the RV Eastward, before getting into the fishing and headboat business. He became well known as the skilled, knowledgeable, fun-loving helmsman of the Carolina Princess, one of the more popular headboats on the southern Outer Banks. Never mind that Harker was prone to seasickness, not an ideal shortcoming for a man, not exactly an ideal shortcoming for a man who made his living on the water. He just took some Dramamine and just kept going, Gould said. He was doing what he loved to do, so he didn't let seasickness hold him back. Harker also became known for his sense of humor and his willingness to help anyone in need, two more reasons he was so loved in his hometown. At one time, you could even spot Woo Woo Harker for President bumper stickers throughout Morehead City. After Harker died in 2006 at age 55, it was his wife Margaret who initiated a fundraising campaign to erect a memorial to her husband, and there were no shortage of willing donors. Beaufort artist Keith Lambert and Willie Baucom Lambert created the monument, which was dedicated on October 31, 2008. Unfortunately, in 2012, the city had to erect a 7-foot-high fence of spiked iron bars around the statue to protect it from vandals. Harker's head peeks over the bars toward the water, reminiscent of that youngster standing on the Pepsi crate to see over the helm. Gould sees the memorial almost daily, and he still pauses from time to time to look at Harker's face and whisper, "Miss you, buddy." The Woo Woo Harker statue is located at 600 Evans Street in Morehead City, North Carolina. The last article is called A Walk Next Door from Waxhaw. Above a creek in Union County, local hikers venture across a suspension bridge that connects us to our southern neighbor. Swaying gently from the weight of its visitors' steps, a suspension bridge crossing from North Carolina into South Carolina hangs 50 feet above 12 Mile Creek. A charm of finches chirps out a song, which is joined by the ribbit of frogs below, as visitors walk carefully across the 170 feet of cables, wood, and nets connecting the two states. The bridge is a segment of the Carolina Thread Trail, a network of more than 400 miles of paths and greenways that spans 15 counties from Iredell County in North Carolina to Lancaster County just below south of the border. The bridge was created not only to connect two parts of the trail, but also to bring communities together no matter which Carolina they call home. Made up of dirt and rocks, boardwalks and sidewalks, the path to the bridge can be accessed from the back of Waxhaw's Harvey Clay Nesbitt Park for about a half-mile walk, or from Walnut Creek Park in Lancaster for about a 3-mile walk. Visitors walking or returning home to North Carolina on the path are welcomed by the stainless steel bench that invites them to sit for a spell and enjoy the connection of the Carolinas. The Harvey Clay Nesbitt Park is located on Nesbitt Park Road in Waxhaw, North Carolina. Well, that sound says we've run out of time for this month's show for Our State Magazine and for today's episode. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next month.